It's not Compton. What's up, punk? It's South Central. A crime wave of gangster made criminals.
South Central Los Angeles. In mainstream media and in the minds of those who don't work or live here, is often branded by the violent and chaotic flashpoints in its history.
South Central Rooted will demonstrate that these events were culminations of the generations of institutional neglect and exploitation that precedes them. Although some of the conditions changed, this legacy still affects South LA residents in all aspects of their daily lives, from housing and employment to transportation, policing, and the environment.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do.
This podcast is based on the report by the same name that was developed with the input of over 30 South LA community-based organizations and institutions and 125 resident leaders, and is also part of the South LA Building Healthy Communities Collaborative. This report explores four intersecting root causes or drivers of disparity in South LA.
In our previous episode, we highlighted the driver of disparity number one, which talks about gentrification, displacement, and homelessness. Community leaders joined the conversation and discussed the trajectory of the housing crisis in South LA, starting from the 2008 recession to the current day housing inequities that have been exacerbated by the pandemic. Our speakers emphasized the power of land use and ownership as solutions for South LA residents to reclaim their neighborhood and advance community ownership. To continue this conversation, in this bonus Driver One episode, we interviewed Pete White with the Los Angeles Community Action Network. Pete provides an important perspective and emphasis on narrative change of homelessness to houselessness, displacement to banishment, and how community members can contribute to safe and community-driven housing solutions. We hope you enjoy it because this is going to be a really good episode.
Yeah, this is Pete White with the LA Community Action Network. We're recording this from live from Skid Row.
All right. And if you can tell us what LA CAN does.
LA Community Action Network, our theory of change rests on three ideas. The very first idea, of course, is power building, community organizing, falls under that. Culture building, litigation, impact litigation, building staff capacity, building an institution that's large enough and broad enough to fight against the state. The second leg, if this were a three-legged stool, is community services. Tonight we're sitting in an LA CAN legal clinic evening. We found that one of the greatest barriers to participation into social justice activities are legal hurdles, right? And so whether that's past criminal offenses to family reunification to eviction protection, all of these things stop people from participating in organizing. And then, of course, the very last thing that we have is community improvement. Right now, our community improvement project is twofold. We have a rooftop garden, y'all can't see it because it's a podcast, where we're using aeroponic technology to provide healthy, fresh food to folks in our community. As well, we have a micro enterprise that's selling medicinal herbs to local restaurants and local catering businesses. And when I say local, local people that look like me and my brown brothers and sisters in Boyle Heights. The other community improvement project that we have right now, we have a affordable housing development that we are flying. We are lifting in South Central Los Angeles. More news on that later. And so those three legs, just because you got to edit this, those three legs of the three-legged stool is community organizing or power building, community improvement, and community services.
So we are in Skid Row right now, the place where there is a high concentration of folks without housing, mm-hmm. And extreme need when it comes to all the services that you mentioned. Was there a strategy behind opening up shop here in the middle of Skid Row?
Yeah, no strategy at all. I came to Skid Row in 1992 after the 1992 rebellion in search of my cousin, because my cousin was struggling with addiction. I'm an L.A. native. And someone told me, yo, I seen your cousin Herm on Skid Row. I'm like, Skid what? Right. And when I grew up, you know, there wasn't really the Fox Hills malls, or the Baldwin Crenshaw Mall, right? The destination for folks, for families, for entertainment was always Broadway, right? Broadway is where all of the Orpheum, the State, right? The Tower, all of these theaters existed, right? And it was actually the place where the real East Los Angeles and the East Side and the West Side of LA came together and met, right? And so I knew all about that hub of downtown Los Angeles, but I had never really traveled east of Los Angeles Street, right? And so somebody was like, yo, I saw your cousin on Fifth and Crocker in Skid Row. I was like, Skid what? I whipped out the Thomas Guide. I bet half the listeners don't even know what the Thomas Guide is.
You're taking us back.
Yeah, I'm taking the podcast way back, right? It was before we had apps. There was like this book and it had all the maps of LA and you could go like Don't Sink My Battleship, G7, and that would put you on a location. It put me on a location in downtown Los Angeles near a mural called the Berlin Wall. And so when I stopped, parked, hopped out at the Berlin Wall, I didn't find my cousin that day, but I found myself. Because everywhere that I looked around me were, at that time, Black people who looked just like me. And so I'm looking at my mother, I'm looking at my sister, I'm looking at my abuela, you know, I'm looking at my abuelo. I'm looking at all my family without being able to find my family. And the thing that struck me odd that day was within a stone's throw, right, of this corner, Fifth and Crocker, when you looked up above, and if we were, I'm going to paint a picture for the listeners, there's always been this mural on Fifth and Crocker, right? The mural's on the second floor of an industrial building, and artists have always called the wall the Berlin Wall. And the images on the mural are images of Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez and Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, all of these heroic individuals in our complex and shared histories, right? But then within a stone's throw right beneath them, the depths of poverty that exists was mind-boggling. And if you looked above, and this is still the fact today, if you looked right above the Berlin Wall mural, you'll see the LA skyline. And so right above this deep poverty, right, this deep, dark poverty, you see Arco Plazas, you see Deloitte and Touche, you see all of these global corporations. And then if you pan your vision northward, you see City Hall. And if you keep spinning to the north or to the northeast, you'll see the Immigration Department and you'll see the Federal Courthouse. And so within a stone's throw of this center of power, a tale of cities existed in front of us and people straight up ignored Black bodies in Skid Row. And so, like I said, I didn't find my cousin that day, but the contradictions was too big for me to ignore, right? I couldn't leave. I couldn't go home that night and not be impacted by the depths of the division. I finally found my cousin, and about 6 months later, he was in a substance abuse rehab spot getting clean and sober. One day, he's leaving the rehab spot called, at that time, it's closed now, it was called Salvation Army Harborlight. Somebody tried to serve him, tried to give him some dope. And he was walking with a lady friend, and he was like, man, I'm getting clean and sober. I've been getting clean and sober for 6 months. Push off. I'm good. The person was persistent, kept pushing on my cousin. My cousin put hands on him, knocked him down, knocked him out, but didn't realize that there was another cat who he was with who had a gun who shot my cousin in his back in Skid Row under the same mural that I just described, Berlin Wall, under the watchful eyes of Frederick Douglass and Cesar Chavez and all of these folks. It's not the good news that I can report is that my cousin lived through that. My cousin lost a large part of his lung, and if it had not been for a nurse or someone who had formal medical training, he would have lost his life, right? This sister, this houseless sister from Skid Row, made sure to give my cousin CPR, made sure to pull his pants off, made sure to take his belt out, made sure to clear his windpipe, right? But then the other thing that was that happened was really amazing. Not only did she stabilize him and wait for the paramedics to get there, but other folks in the community ran the shooter down and held the shooter down. I'm going to say that again. Other folks in the community ran the shooter down and held the shooter down. Unheard of in Los Angeles. Unheard of in many communities anywhere on this planet. But that's what happened in Skid Row. And so Skid Row saved my cousin's life. And it was very clear to me that it was my duty, man. It was my duty to not see Skid Row's through a narrative or through the eyes, and we'll get into that in a second, through a narrative or the lies that are sold on people who are poor in this country, right? And that became sort of the pursuit for me, how we could build an organization that begins to respond to those lies, but ultimately build power and expand our bandwidth to exact change in this community and in this country.
Is your cousin doing okay today?
So my cousin today, he's doing well. I trained him to organize. He was organizing. He's my older cousin. It's funny, I trained him to organize. And he organized with LA CAM for about 7 years. He also did substance abuse counseling. And so taking his experiences and trying to help other folks find sobriety and deal with the disease of addiction, right? And now he's married and living in Atlanta, living his best life, right? And so it's a good ending to that story.
What an inspiring story. So today in Los Angeles, you can't get away from the tents in the streets. They're virtually everywhere. For a long time, Skid Row was the only place in Los Angeles where you would see such a sight. And that's what this topic is that we're unpacking today, is this issue of the housing crisis and how it's created such a vast number of houseless people. Mm-hmm. It used to be this notion that those who ended up living on the streets were often people with mental health issues or folks that for whatever reason ended up there, through no fault of their own, but it was just sort of, they became these like invisible folks who were out, living in the streets. Today, you see folks from all walks of life who have to live in these tents or these makeshift houses out in the streets. So can you help us, paint the picture, unpack why it is that Los Angeles is facing such a housing crisis today?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a great question. There's lots of things in there to address. I think the very first thing that we need to address is that while Skid Row has always had the highest concentration of houseless people, and so what that means, the highest number of houseless people in one concentrated area, the largest number of houseless people have always existed in South Central Los Angeles, right? I'm going to say that again. So Skid Row has always been sort of the capital of the concentration, but South Central Los Angeles has always had more folks. It's interesting. Professor Dan Flaming from the Economic Roundtable wrote some time ago about this thing that he called a phenomena that he called the corridor of poverty, right? And he sort of maps this corridor between South Central Los Angeles, right, all the way to Compton to Skid Row, right? And he shows you that within this corridor, right, the levels of the highest levels of unemployment in the city, right? The highest levels of school dropout in the country, right? The highest levels of unaffordable housing or slum housing in the country. But he shows you that within that corridor, folks would travel from between South Central Los Angeles to downtown Los Angeles in search of what? Housing. What's that housing stock that they were in search of? Well, in downtown Los Angeles, we've always had a high number of residential housing hotel units, right? And so it was the only place in the city, right, coming up through the 80s and the 90s, quite frankly, that for $300, $400 per month, you could at least have a room. And if you were lucky, you could have a room with a bathroom. And so downtown Los Angeles during the 80s and 90s would be the place where if people were down on their luck and couldn't afford rent elsewhere, they would come downtown, right? The other thing that we know downtown has had for 100 years were soup kitchens, right? And those soup kitchens, mind you, weren't for black poor folks. They were for folks who were considered hobos, right? Largely white folks, right? Those soup kitchens were created, and there's a gang of history on this. Those soup kitchens were largely created during the Great Depression, right? And because downtown is adjacent to the railways, I know that got loud. And because downtown is adjacent to the railways, this is how folks literally traveled west, right? And so people see the soup kitchens, but I would say forget about the soup kitchens for a second. Let's think about the residential hotels. Let's think about the entertainment. A lot of the entertainment in downtown before gentrification and after gentrification was bars, saloons, bathhouses, things for a largely male population. Now, fast forward to the 80s, right? The early 80s and the early 90s and crack cocaine and the crack cocaine epidemic, you would see more and more African-Americans coming down this way. But the other thing, let me be really clear, I said crack cocaine, but the reason you see people here is not crack cocaine. And the reason you see poor African-American houseless people is not a crack cocaine story. The other story that it's not, like the general narrative around houselessness. And this is kind of, this is weird. I've been organizing, now y'all know, since the 90s. And in the 90s, the narrative of why people were houseless, right, was never about housing, right? It was always about personal failures. It was always this idea of meritocracy. Yo, you just didn't try hard enough. You had five jobs, but you just weren't trying hard enough, right? And there was always a narrative around substance abuse and mental illness. I got you. And there was always a narrative placed in front of us about substance abuse and mental illness. I think one of the myths, one of the craziest myths, and finally, it's taken me like 25 years to undo all this stuff, right? One of the myths, and I'm sure y'all have heard this one in the room, is that the reason you see so many folks suffering with mental illness on the streets of Los Angeles is because Ronald Reagan shut down the mental health hospitals. Haven't we all heard that? Yes, we have all heard that myth. The reality, however, is that the mental health hospitals were actually shut down during the Kennedy administration, right? Deinstitutionalization happened 40 years before Ronald Reagan was on the scene, right? What Ronald Reagan was responsible for, because all of the mental health hospitals were already closed, is that he started scaling back the community-based mental health services dollars, right? But think about this. Think about policy that's written, right, for 30, 40 years to address a problem that's rooted in broken people and not broken systems, right? Also absent, and this gets into some of the other stuff, also absent, and this is the narrative that we've published, that we've studied, that we've written about, and finally, after 25 years, the city is parroting. You can't talk about poverty and houselessness in Los Angeles without talking about redlining and segregation. You can't talk about poverty in Los Angeles without talking about deinstitutionalization, right? The loss of jobs, right? If you go down Slauson or if you go down Alameda, all of those warehouses and all of those industrial sites is places where black folks used to work. When deindustrialization shut those factories down, guess what happened? There was no replacement jobs for those folks. When Boeing and Lockheed Martin and McDonnell Douglas and all those places left, all the black folks that were clawing and finally had the ability to live the American dream, I'm saying the air quotes, when they finally had that ability and they had the rug pulled out from under them, there was nothing else there for them. But then the story goes on. Also, so we had deinstitutionalization, right? We had, deindustrialization. We had jobs leaving. We had welfare reform. You had Hillary Clinton talking about super predators, right? Right around the time, right before the time that the drug war is in its full sort of, its full thing. And with that comment and with that testimony from a Hillary and Bill Clinton, we see a crime bill. a 1994 crime bill that leads to the building of 21 prisons in the state of California. And then lastly, we have NAFTA, right? The North American Free Trade Act. And so in many ways, people talk about, yo, those are personal choices that people are making. And that's really an attempt to blind you on the fact that those were all political and structural and racist as choices that were made on the backs of poor Black. And then by this point, poor Black and brown communities, right? And so it's funny to us now in 2020 to finally hear folks in the city of Los Angeles, the mayor's office and the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority say the root causes of homelessness, the three leading causes of houselessness, we don't even call it homelessness, is housing availability, housing affordability, and poverty. The thing that racks our mind is, it's always been about housing affordability, housing availability, and poverty. And it's always been about the ways in which opportunities are removed for some at the expense of others. It's crazy. What people need to realize is that if this system of capitalism is there to exploit you, you still have value. Right. As a human being, you don't have much value, but you have value to this system. It's when you're despised. It's when people say there is nothing here for you that literal and physical death occurs. Right. And so when we think about and when we talk about and when we write about houselessness, it's from this fuller narrative. Right. And it's from a full wholesale breakdown of a system that we know has not been here for us. I think Manuel, bringing it back up forward a little bit, good friend, Professor Manuel Pastor, in his work, Roots and Raices, where he's tracking immigrant migratory patterns, he knows that you can't talk about immigrants without first talking about Black folks and Black immigrants and others. He shows in his 10-year census data that everywhere in Los Angeles, in every census tract in Los Angeles, African Americans are disappearing in everyone except one. And that one would be in Skid Row. So you can't find us in any place but in a Skid Row. It's phenomenal work. And anyone who's listening should definitely pick up a copy of Roots and Raices by Dr. Manuel Pastor.
You talked about redlining and segregation. Can you tell the listeners what redlining is?
Oh, absolutely. The easiest form for listeners to understand is that the federal government and banks literally drew a red line around particular communities that could not rent to African Americans. I'm gonna say that again. I don't know if y'all heard me. The federal government, right, and banks and institutions drew a red line around communities that would bar African Americans from entering or owning property in them. Think about this. I just slept on the architect's name because I'm talking. We've had architects, the most famous Black architect. And I don't know why I forgot his name.
Give me. He designed the LAX.
He designed everything. Yeah, What's his name? See, me and you both.
Yeah.
Is it Paul Williams? So if that's it, you're right.
He designed the Golden State Mutual.
Paul Williams. I mean, it's crazy when you think about redlining. You think about architects like Paul Williams, the first Black architect that was allowed into the Architects Institute of America, right? We're talking about a Black architect who could not visit the homes that he built after dark. He built a ton of homes in Culver City. And Culver City, unbeknownst to many folks, had some of the latest lasting sundown laws in history. Sundown laws were laws that said if you were Black, you could not be in town after the sun went down. So think about that. So in the 30s and the 40s in Los Angeles, in the 50s in Los Angeles, there were still sundown laws. And the guy who built the most luxurious houses there couldn't even visit, right? And so that's a Los Angeles. And that's a story that speaks to the absurdity of redlining, right? Even more so, like the person who builds the houses can't even visit.
Yeah. So you alluded to the fact that so much blame is placed on the individuals once they find themselves houseless. But we know, especially during the Great Recession, that people were pushed to the streets because of the subprime lending crisis that was driven by banks themselves.
That's right.
And banks like Wells Fargo were forced to pay millions of dollars for their practices, which disproportionately impacted Black families and then Latino families. And so, can you talk about the history of banks and the role that they've played in contributing to people of color, particularly Black people, ending up on the streets?
Yep. And so, just going back to the days of redlining, historians will tell you now, the one asset that led to the deep or the depths of poverty in Black families was the inability to own property, was the inability to own homes. The fact that federally backed loans and banks straight out legally denied Black people home loans is one of the core reasons that researchers and historians and others cite that Black wealth is 10% of that of white wealth, right? 10%. I'm going to say that again. 10% of that of white wealth, right? The other thing, when we think about the mortgage meltdown, I think I want everyone to be really clear. Those hardest hit during the mortgage meltdown were single women head of household families, Black and brown families, right? They were women, right? Who had worked as hard as they possibly could to cobble together enough money for a down payment, right? Into these exotic loans, right? When those exotic loans came due, of course, these women, and they were largely women, could not pay back the loans. And after that, we would see a steady increase of Black women houselessness, as well as an increase in Latinas houselessness in Los Angeles, right? And so the thing that's really wild about that, a lot of folks don't really talk about the mortgage meltdown. So we all know that the banks got bailed out, right? We know the banks didn't take a hit. We know that Obama, right? President Obama helped them out, right? But what we don't know is that not only did a lot of these mortgage companies, these exotic mortgage companies, get bailed out, but they sort of remixed who they were and what they've done, right? And so we'll say a company like Blackstone, right, who was one of the premier exotic loan givers to folks in our communities, goes belly up. The federal government comes in, bails Blackstone out. Blackstone then goes back into South Central Los Angeles and starts buying up all of the property, single family houses, as well as duplexes, right, and fourplexes, and buys them up and is now renting them, right, at 3 and 4 times the rate, right, and really fueling gentrification and banishment of folks from our communities. That's why when you go in Leimert Park, it's not odd. You know, I'm not hating, but it's not odd to go through with Leimert Park and see the turbo baby carriage with the white family looking around like, yo, this is our neighborhood now, right? It's not an odd sight to see, even today, a U-Haul truck with Black and brown families being shipped out, and a day later, white families buying in, right? It's interesting. I've been doing, like I said, this work a long time. And when the redevelopment agency, was an agency that ceased to exist about a decade ago, but was responsible for taking local taxes from businesses and investing that, what they called tax increment financing, TI financing, into affordable housing. And so when we started doing this work, we saw gentrification coming. And when I say gentrification, it's the displacement of poor people of color with communities of higher means. What does that mean in Los Angeles and places like this? It means Black and brown folks being moved out for white folks, right? It was interesting that the CRA would say to me in those fights, repeat, we've been trying hard to get them back into this community, and we're going to give them, and these are air quotes, what they want in order to come back, right? And so what does that mean? What the CRA was saying is that after the 1960s rebellion, there was a phenomenon called white flight, right? And with white flight came this, I would say, this experiment called gated communities and suburbs, right? And so for like 30 and 40 years, white folks were living in the suburbs in Palmdale and Antelope Valley, and we're out here, and we're out here with Boeing, right? But for them, when the when deindustrialization hit, many of those folks had houses, and so they had savings, and so they were good. They'd already purchased their houses, and they were good. But at some point, they got tired of living out there and commuting to Los Angeles every day, like anyone would, right? You're on the freeway 3 and 4 hours a day. That means you're not with your families. And the city needed that wealthier tax base in the central core to make things all right. And so what you're seeing now is a reverse of white flight. It's white return coming back into our communities. And cities and governments and others is doing everything they can to promote it. I think one other thing, and this is really, really important, another phenomenon that has shifted, and I think it's good for people who are listening on this podcast. So I'm an organizer. I've been an organizer a long time. And on the housing side of organizing, we've always imagined that if you build, so I talk about this phenomenon, the dance of the cranes, right? If you look at any skyline in Los Angeles, you see these cranes that are like just dancing, right? These booms that are dancing. And then you hear in your ears, it's hard to build. It's hard to build in LA. It's expensive. But, you know, I'm like, I can't tell. You telling me not to believe my lying eyes, because there's stuff being built everywhere, right? And so for us, one of the old school thinking of housing organizers was, well, if they just keep building, like I see a proliferation of booms in the skies, there ain't enough wealthy people. Like at some point, those units have to be for us, right? And we were literally sort of locked into that idea that we're going to fight for some good percentage of the housing. But at some point, they're going to have to lower the rents. Unbeknownst to us, this practice that's been happening overseas for the last 40 years called the financialization of housing is going down. What the financialization of housing means, in short, is that housing development, right, it has now become a place where wealthy people park capital. It's also a place where investments are happening, right? And so now housing is bought and traded and invested on in the stock market. Why is that important? Because housing is no longer being built for humans to live in. And this idea that empty apartments or empty lofts, so back in the day, we would say, when we listened to developers, they would say, well, we need, you know, such AMI or income levels in there for the project to pencil out. What they're saying is it needs to be 80% full and 90% full, or it's not going to work out for us. That was 20 years ago thinking. Now, an empty loft can remain empty and still turn a profit, right? And so from London to Los Angeles, you have all of these mansions and these mini mansions and all of these properties that are just corporate investments, right? For folks who are parking or hiding money. That becomes important because now it explains, or at least it reorients our thinking and our strategies to make sure housing is a human right. Because if folks don't know that, what we're gonna do, we're going to sit back, like I thought, and wait for those rents to come down. Or we're going to sit back and say, yo, that building's been empty for 4 years. It's someday they have to open it up. And the reality is that they don't.
That's some shit.
Yeah, BHC, that's some real shit.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So I want to talk about Clyde Woods.
Oh yeah.
What do you know about Clyde Woods? He has a theory called asset stripping. Can you talk about that theory?
I can. So first of all, Clyde Woods, rest in peace. That was my man. Clyde Scholarship enlightened. So let me say this before we talk about Clyde. We will talk about Clyde, though. As an organizer, one of my mentors back in the day said, the real measurement of a leader is not how many speeches that leader can make, but it's really the measurement that we should apply to leadership is how many other leaders have you trained that went on to train other leaders, right? So it ain't about good speeches. It ain't about being in front of cameras. It's about doing the rigorous work of developing leaders and preparing them to develop other leaders. And so if we apply that to the academic setting, that's who Clyde Woods was. Very quiet academic who really looked at early on the ways in which the intersections of the criminal injustice system and the ways in which it removed opportunity from Black and brown people. It's funny, when I met Clyde, I was talking to him. I was like, yo, Clyde, it's like they're looting our spirits. They're looting our opportunities. And he looked at me and he smiled. He was like, yeah, you're right. He was like, but I call it asset stripping. And what it is, it's a process that suggests each time poor people engage or are engaged by law enforcement, their ability to get out of this cage of poverty is the hurdles are raised higher and higher and higher, right? And so, and he also would show in his work where if they weren't catching you up in this process of asset stripping quick enough, that they would roll out, and I'm about to trip y'all out on this one, they would roll out tools by which to make sure they remove as much opportunity as possible. So we grew up in the 30s. How many times have we seen in the 30s or other places the LAPD sting of where they leave a bicycle or they leave a car door open, like they'll arrest somebody, they'll arrest you, and then they take you away and they just leave a car there, and then someone else goes and gets in the car? That's a process of asset stripping. Clyde Woods would show that after in Hurricane Katrina, the police would literally take a pack of cigarettes. They'd see an abandoned car. They'd take a pack of cigarettes and a lighter or a box of cigarettes, put it on the dash after a hurricane, after a fucking hurricane. And when you went in that vehicle and you took those cigarettes out of this unlocked vehicle that's in the middle of a field, they would arrest you for burglary, and they'd give you a felony, right? For that, because Louisiana is a whole lot different than Los Angeles, right? But this is the process that he talks about, and the process literally just shows the ways in which the criminal injustice system intersects with the daily lives of poor people to remove all opportunities that could potentially be before them. Where'd you come up with Clyde Woods?
I want to.
That's a good one.
I like to learn. So I want to talk about South LA is starting to see gentrification more and more, especially mm-hmm. in the last decade with the growth of USC and the mm-hmm. Metro. You mentioned Leimert Park, but now there's white people in the jungles. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about South Los Angeles, yep. and let's talk about what gentrification means for a community like South mm-hmm. Los Angeles.
So first of all, we're going to stop saying South Los Angeles. We're going to say South Central. We're going to say for the areas that we're talking about right now, South Central Los Angeles. It's one of those things. I've been trained, I've been taught, and I've been teaching that once you see gentrification, it's too late to stop it, right? So I'm going to say that again. Once you see gentrification, and so once you see three art galleries, four coffee shops, and two dog walking services in your neighborhood, it is far too late to stop the process of gentrification, right? Because gentrification, when it is kicked into high gear, if you talk to politicians, they'll say it's market driven. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's primed by politicians and policies, right? And so the easing of restrictions, right? The giving away, I'm going to say that again, of properties in downtown Los Angeles, For example, when gentrification happened, the Community Redevelopment Agency literally gave away free rents at all of the ground floor residential hotels for artists to make it. And this is like grants forgiveness, right, for 5 years. So for 5 years, these artists and these small businesses, all white, right, had the ability to move into this prime real estate for the sole purpose of breaking it in, right, breaking it in for their friends. Funny story about that, though, is after those 5 years, most of those art galleries and most of those businesses were also booted out, right? Because they're living high on the hog is an old Southern metaphor, like living high on the hog and saying, well, I got this prime real estate, I don't have any overhead, I'm just going to do what I need to do, right? So waiting to see the same thing and started to see the same thing happening in South Central Los Angeles, right? Where CRA was drawing maps indicating the areas that they wanted to come and sort of take over. Leimert Park, of course, has always been a destination. One of the other things about gentrification, it likes finding those culturally relevant areas, right? So Leimert Park has always been a hub for culture and art. But as I've always said, art has no address. And so for them, we can come in, right? And we can sell the idea of Leimert Park without Black people. And so that's what we're seeing now, right? And so in the plans, we see historic towers going up where Phillips Barbecue was at. And those towers aren't going to be for Black folks who used to live in Leimert Park. Those towers are drawing in an audience that they want. The other thing, when you talk about South Central Los Angeles, you know, when you look at what's happening around Crenshaw Baldwin, we see a Kaiser that just went in there. But we also see a pitched battle, right, with the Crenshaw Subway Coalition fighting back against a Black developer who's fighting back against bringing any affordable housing at any levels into the Crenshaw Baldwin Marlinton Square areas. For those who don't know, if y'all ain't LA natives, that's the jungles, right? Mm-hmm. We also then see when we go up in the J's proper, white families moving into what used to be the only bastion of affordable housing, right? Non-public, non-public affordable housing on the West Coast. And so you see all of these things happening. I talked about displacement 20 years ago, right? When you use the term displacement, it's a term that suggests you have somewhere else to go, right? You're being displaced from one neighborhood, but there's another neighborhood that can accommodate you, right? And so I'm leaving South Central. I'm displaced from South Central to come to downtown because I can afford the downtown rent, but not South Central. I talk now in the terms of banishment. And UCLA professor Ananya Roy has now created a theoretical framework based on my definition of banishment and gentrification, which ultimately means you no longer have any place to go, right? Because if gentrification is happening in South Central, in Boyle Heights, in Inglewood, right, in all the areas where you're from, there is no place for you but the sidewalks, but the streets, right? There is no place for you. And so what we're seeing now is a wave of banishment from the cities. And that's why Dr. Pastor could say in Roots Raices, there's only one place that African-Americans are showing up and it's in Skid Row. And that's not everybody, right? And that's not everybody.
So can anything be done to stop it?
Yeah, organizing. And so we're a 501c3 organization, right? But there's more and more C4 organizations that are cropping up. More and more 501c3s also have 501c4s. So many organizations, most social justice organizations are 501c3s, right? And so in short, these are nonprofit organizations that can't take positions on candidates, but they can take positions on issues, right? Finally, in 2020, lots of organizations know that they need to actually have a greater voice in electoral politics, right? And so different organizing strategies are emerging. Things like IVE, which is in short, integrated voter engagement, right? Where you're engaging voters and you're trying to pull voters into your base. This is still a 501c3 acceptable practice. But in addition to that, you have organizations going for 501c4 status, which allows you to support candidates, right? And so if you have a 501c3 and then you have an associated 501c4, you now have the ability to talk about policy, you have the ability to get with voters, and you also have the ability to put pressure on those who oftentimes look like you but are not doing bidding in your best interests, right? And so it's a question of leadership, political leadership. It's all, when we talk about gentrification, the only way to stop gentrification is going to be strong political leadership, right? Political leadership that says, I don't care if I'm a one-term elected official. I am going to hold it down for my community, right? I am going to set in motion policies and practices that ensure my people can stay, one. Two, just stronger organizing, like a deeper investment in organizing, and not just organizing meetings and not just building infrastructure, but introducing cultural work into our organizing, right? Music, arts, poetry, and all of these things that actually reach the ears, the hearts, and the minds of folks who tired of hearing the political speech, but who are ready to move, right? Who are thus inspired by something over beats. And then lastly, I'll say, for our organizations and for our leaderships, figuring out a real transition plan for old heads, right? And so figuring out how the roles, like if we're talking about the art of war, you know, everyone has a role, right? Let the cowards dig, right? All the way down to the cowards. The cowards can dig holes. However, for us, what we find is that the elders in our movement are holding on to the baton far too long. We're holding on to the baton until we die and not creating a real succession plan with the young heads, right? And so we have to move our elders out of this this organization leadership into this eldership, right? And giving tutelage and learning from younger folks who can bring 2020 solutions to 2020 problems, right? And it's those things that we have got, and there's many more, but it's those types of things that we've got to institute if we have a chance at staying in our communities.
Are there any elected officials in Los Angeles today who are demonstrating that courage that you described?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, yeah and no. That's a symptom of us not having the ability to build enough power to make those that we put in power afraid of us, right? And so what's happening, we're putting people in power and they're like, I'm from them. I know exactly what they can accomplish. I'll split them and I'll tell them, well, if you just wait a little while, I'm gonna figure out the game, I'm gonna help you out. Dr. King said in his letter from a Birmingham jail, the word wait for the Negro means never, right? No matter who says it, the word wait, if you hear the word wait for the Negro, that means never. And so now if we fast forward it, man, wait for the Negro, wait for my immigrant la gente, I mean, wait for my Latino cousins means never. Anytime we hear wait, we got to be like, nah, we finna smash through you, right? And so for me, that's hopefully what this report says to folks, like, we are not broken people. Here's the last thing I'm gonna say, and then I'm gonna be done. So another thing a mentor of mine taught me way back in the day, one of those things you never forget, was the definition of a broken system, right? Because we always talk about, yo, that system is broke, that system is broken, right? We not broken, the system is broken, right? But he made me sort of interrogate that idea. And made me see that the definition of a broken system is a system whose measurements or whose outcomes can't be measured. Say that again. The definition of a broken system is a system whose outcomes can't be measured, right? Now let's think about that. Every system that interacts with our people, we can measure, or they have already measured the outcomes. We know how many students are not going to graduate from fucking high school from the third grade, right? We know that, like the system knows that. We know how many people are going to drop out. We know how many people don't have jobs and not going to have jobs. We know how many people are going to be houseless, right? And so what does this mean? If they already know the measurements of the outcome, the system isn't broken. The system is working as it should work, right? And so for us, we have to think about, so how do we disrupt the system? How do we break the system and rebuild the system in a way that talks about reparation, right? And reparations and healings. How do we build enough or muster enough strength and power to where every damn thing that's broken isn't led by the police department? Think about that. The police department with community policing now, they're in our schools, they're doing coaching, they got football teams, they got all kind of stuff. But they also got 57% of the general fund budget at the same time when libraries are closing, schools are closing, services are pure D shit, right? And so it's more about using this report to sort of break the movement or break these organizations out of these silo-based ways of thinking about our communities. You think our students, when they leave home, the only thing that they was worried about was that metal detector? When they get home, they hungry, right? Moms and pops or big sister or big brother, whoever's taking care of them, ain't got a job either, right? Our issues aren't silo-based, right? And we've got to figure out the intersections and the places which we need to connect together so our organizing can be connected for greater impact.
I want to ask you one last question.
Damn, you got a whole lot of them.
I know. So I want to ask about police oppression.
Uh-oh.
And that'll be the last question that I'll ask.
Let's do it.
Because, and just so you know, this may make it into another episode where we talk about the role of the police in communities of color.
Yep.
We know that more and more there's talk about police in Skid Row and, you know, getting the right type of training. But let's not focus on that. What I want to talk about is the role that that police and law enforcement has played in the history of displacing people of color and suppressing communities of color, particularly Black communities.
I'm gonna make this one easy for y'all. And so the second in command, for a number of years in the LAPD was a Black dude named Chief Earl Paysinger.
Rest in peace.
Chief Earl Paysinger. Chief Paysinger and L.A. Can went back a long way, right? And so Chief Paysinger would be sort of, when the police department was arresting our organizers, Chief Paysinger was the head up in LAPD that was like, yo, what are we doing? Can we negotiate a ceasefire? Right? He was that head. Before Chief Paysinger passed, his latest post, his last post, he retired from the LAPD, and he was at USC, and he was in charge of community services. And I met with him 3 weeks before he died, and he had this to say. He said, you know what, Pete? There's two things in my life as a police officer that I regret. He was like, and I want to tell you this. Now, I don't know why he felt that day he wanted to tell me, and we were straight, we were cool. But he said, the two things that I regret most and that I got to live with is, one, the lie that the police department was used in the 1984 Olympics to make the area safe. Because, so for folks who don't know, during the 1984 Olympics, everyone in South Central, anywhere near the police department, all the way down to like 101st Street, all Black men were arrested. They arrested all Black men because being safe meant Black men not being seen by white and international visitors. So he looked at me. He was like, man, I apologize for that. He said, and the second thing that I regret is the Safer Cities Initiative in Skid Row. And so for folks who don't know, so from 2006 to 2009, the LAPD made 27,000 arrests and 36,000 citations in a 25 square block area of Skid Row. Right. We called it catch and release. At that time, Bill Bratton would come to town and say, and he would quip, right? And it's one of the reasons we ran him out of town. He would quip that he just wished that the Constitution could go on break for a little while so he could do the work that he needed to do in Los Angeles, like he did to the squeegee men in New York. And so during this time, you had all of these arrests of black and poor people. And it wasn't just to make white folks in the gentrifying downtown feel safe. It was also to send a signal to investors who, at the time when Antonio Villaraigosa was mayor, every time he went and tried to get foreign capital, the capitalists would say, so what are you going to do with Skid Row, right? And so with all of these arrests, and the story gets tighter than that, right? So after they made all of these arrests, of course, we're organizing. Of course, we're court watching. Before court watching became a thing, we were doing court watching. And the public defenders hit us up and said, yo, LA Can, there's something that I think y'all need to know, that in CCB, that's the busiest courtroom. The downtown courtroom is the busiest courtroom in the region. There are files coming through from prosecutors with red stamps on them that says Fifth Street corridors, no plea deals. So when I talk about banishment, this is what banishment looks like. This isn't displacement. This is banishment. Fifth Street corridor, no plea deals. That is unconstitutional. You cannot take a stack of cases from a designated area and say that justice for them looks different than anyone else in the city. So, of course, we're organizers. We found out. We blew it up. We hit up the courts. We hit them up so hard that the then presiding judge, a judge by the name of Judge Van Sicklin, called together academics, business people, the police department, and other judges. Note, he didn't call grassroots organizations that put it on blast, and had a whole day conversation about what should the court's role be in gentrification.
How to contribute to it.
What should the court's role be, right? At this point, it can't be how do we contribute to it, because now we've busted your entire court actually disenfranchising an entire population of people. But now that he's busted, the only recourse that he has is, hands up, don't shoot, y'all got me. What should our role be? But to your point, the fact that he actually called a meeting and said, what should the court's role be in gentrification, should allow us to understand the interaction between the legal injustice system and capital, right? It's plantation capitalism at its best. And so for me, that experience, right, led to me being able to train folks deeper in South Central about the role of police. And now, so 3-4 years ago, when all of the development was starting to happen around the Crenshaw Baldwin Mall, we also saw at the exact same time more and more sweeps of the area. The other thing that we saw more and more evictions in the J's, in the jungles, right? A lot of those evictions lead to or are led by nuisance abatement complaints, right? And so I would say the gateway to gentrification in our communities start with policing, right? And so you have the quiet policy, right? The quiet policy that says this is going to go here. We're going to ease restrictions on height. And then the police are used as the force, as the military, to remove as many people as possible. And this is where Clyde Woods and asset stripping comes in. The other thing that Bill Bratton, the great thing about him being a braggart from Boston, you know, he would also say, well, our role isn't just to arrest everyone. It's to get everyone on paper and put them in a vulnerable position so we can arrest them later. And so that's where the FI cards come in. That's where the gross ticketing comes in, right? Giving you so many tickets you can't pay. There was a sister in Skid Row named Annie Moody, got 127 tickets. Wow. Annie Moody was a G. She took a plea deal on nothing. She made him take every case to trial, every case to trial. I wish I could say we was doing some mad organizing, but this was just who she was, right? And so plantation capitalism is still alive and well, and it's not going to stop unless we stop it.
This podcast is made possible by the generous investments of the California Endowment. The content is taken from the South LA Rudy Report, which is written by Laura Murata and Eric Watt in collaboration with Special Service for Groups Incorporated.
The show is produced at the Hood Digest Digilab. It's narrated by Marlo J. and Elmer Roldan. The theme music features original content from South Central Cartel's South Central Madness and original music produced by Rico Pavon. The podcast is produced by Daniel Castillo and Brian Aguilar. Our assistant producer is Nelly Arciniega.
Subscribe, share, comment, and like the South LA Rooted podcast on all platforms.